So in this Gita Dhyanam, which was composed by Sri Madhusudan Saraswati, a great saint of India, it is a homage to Mother Gita, to Ved Vyas ji, who wrote the Mahabharata, and of course Bhagwan Sri Krishna himself, who is the original source of the Bhagavad Gita. And we have done 6 verses in the past couple of weeks. Those who have missed it, you can go to Google Talks by Dr. Anil Mehta. Just go to Talks by Dr. Anil Mehta, or go to firstpower.info. Tony puts the talks on, so you can listen to the previous shlokas. Also, all previous commentaries on Bhagavad Gita that we have done and meditation, they are all available there. So in the first 6 verses, I'll just summarize very briefly. The first verse, Om Parthasya Pratibodhitam, Parthaya Pratibodhitam, is the homage to Mother Gita, who in 18 chapters gives us the message of Advaita. Advaita means there is not two, there is one. Brahman alone is appearing as all of us and as this world. So me and Brahman and the world, everything is one. So that Advaita message is the main message of the Bhagavad Gita, which was composed by Ved Vyas ji, who was a, we believe was the incarnation of Lord Vishnu himself. And the second verse is an homage to Ved Vyas ji, who was very intelligent, brilliant, but at the same time had lot of love and compassion. See, it's rare to find two things in the same individual. People who are very brilliant become arrogant. People who are loving and compassionate, you know, they get just caught up in the love. But he was a combination of both intelligence and love. And then the third verse is to homage to Lord Krishna, who, just as a cowherd drives the cows, he was a cowherd. He's the one who drives our mind towards him and in the right direction. So that's why we honor Lord Krishna himself, who is the Parijata tree, who is the one that gives us whatever we wish. And the question is, what do we wish for? You ask God for things, he'll give you things. If you ask God for God, he'll give you himself. So what do we want? That's the choice. Most of the time we make the other choice. God, give me this, give me that. And we use God as an instrument to get something else. And he says, okay, if you want that, tathastu, you can have it. But if you want me, then you have to ask for me and me alone. Just as Duryodhana and Arjuna both had a choice. Krishna said, you want me or you want my entire army of 11 Akshohanis, 11 regiments, all well equipped. And I'll be alone. I won't pick any arms. I won't fight. Duryodhana said, Krishna alone without arms is useless. I don't want him. I'll take the 11 regiments. Arjuna said, Lord, if I have you, I don't need anything else. So he made the right choice and he emerged successful. And that's what this message is, that we have to choose the right way. And constantly in life, the Gita tells us that you will have a choice between the right and the wrong, the good and the bad, the high and the low. And the choice is, which one do we pick? The fourth verse, Sarvopanishado Gavo Dokta Gopalanandana. So the Upanishads are the cows, and the cowherd is Krishna. As we know, Krishna was a cowherd when he lived on earth. And just as a cow is milked and the essence is enjoyed first by the calf and then by everybody else, so similarly the essence of the Upanishads are the cows, and the Gita is the essence which Bhagavan Sri Krishna brought for all of us so that we may enjoy it. But who was the first one to get it? Arjuna. He is the calf. Just as the cow gives the milk for the calf, so Upanishads give this message. And Krishna gave this message first to Arjuna, who experienced it, and then all of us enjoy the Bhagavad Gita. And then, of course, the fifth verse is again a praise of Lord Krishna, who was the son of Vasudeva and Devaki and who destroyed a lot of demons. And he is the supreme joy, and that is whom we seek and whom we honor. And then in the sixth verse, which we did last time, all the obstacles that Arjuna faced, Bhishma, who had Ichchamrityu, who could not be killed, he had to decide when he wants to die. Drona was the greatest warrior, the teacher of both the Kauravas. Karna was as good as Arjuna, if not better. and Jayadrath, all the great warriors. Not only that, but the Kaurava army was much larger than the Pandava army, much more better equipped, and still Arjuna, of course, with the help of the Pandava forces, was able to overcome. Why? Because God was on his side. So that's what they said, the river of Mahabharata had to be crossed by Arjuna, and all these obstacles, the rocks and the crocodiles and currents, which are all the obstacles which Arjuna faced. Compared to that, our obstacles are not that much. We may think, oh, I have so many problems. But look at the problems Arjuna faced. So compared to that, so if we have Lord on our side, definitely we can all overcome all obstacles in life. So today we'll do the verse 7, 8 and 9. And then if we have time, I'll do a general introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. So we just chanted Para Sharya Vacha Saroja Mamalam Gitartha Gandotkatam. It is the 7th verse. And all these commentaries are in this book. You can read them later on. Right now, if you just listen to me, but you should later on read the commentaries written by Gurudev, and also word by word meaning. So Parasharya Vacha, Parashar. So Parashar was Ved Vyasji's father. So the son of Parashar is called Parashar. Like the son of Vasudev is called Vasudev. Krishna is called Vasudev because he was the son of Vasudev. So the son of Parashar Rishi is Parashar. So why is he honored? It's a very interesting story of how the Lord appeared on earth. When Vishnu had to appear on earth as Lord Krishna, he had to choose suitable parents. You know, parents who obviously to bear the Lord and to give birth to the Lord, the mother has to be very divine, the father has to be very evolved. Ordinary people like Vasudeva and Devaki, when Krishna had to appear, or when Ram had to appear, you know, Dasharath and Yashoda, very evolved people. So same way, how did Vishnu appear as Ved Vyasji? So it's an interesting story. So there was a great Rishi named Parashar, very evolved, realized master, full of wisdom and knowledge. And in his meditation, the Lord tells him that you are going to be the instrument for me to appear. He said, Lord, look, I'm a Rishi, I'm a Brahmachari, I have not had contact with women in years, and I have no interest. But if that is your order, I will do it. So he was going on a boat, crossing a river, and the boat person was a lady, very adventurous, very strong, because she used to single-handedly row the boat and alone face all the currents. Sometimes the river had, you know, currents and storms, and she would take people across. Very brave, very adventurous, and very daring lady. You know, because a lady to row a boat and be a boatman single-handedly was... So it so happened that on that boat, there were just two of them, just Parashar Rishi and this lady. Her name was Matsyagandha. So Matsyagandha means one who has the smell of fish, because she dealt with fish all the time. And so as they were crossing the river, suddenly the cloud came and it became very dark. Even in the middle of the day, the sun became completely dark and nothing could be seen. And the clouds descended on the river. And in that darkness, Parashar got the instruction. So he impregnated her. And then when the boat reached the other side, he got off and walked away. Not that, oh, this is my son and my wife and what am I going to do without you? None of that. His job was done, finished. He went on his spiritual journey, never looked back, never saw who that lady was, where she was. Because he, you know, he was a realized Rishi. He was not interested in building a family and all. And so this mother then gave birth to Ved Vyasji. And so the Ved Vyasji is very interesting. He had the wisdom of his father, the realization, the evolved nature of his father. And he had the courage and bravery and the adventure of his mother. So it was a beautiful combination of two wonderful souls, wonderful people who went in Ved Vyasji. So Ved Vyasji not only got us the essence of the entire Upanishads, the entire literature of Hinduism was was organized by Ved Vyasji, by one single individual. Gurudev says, if we owe the survival of Hinduism to one person, that is him. Even though there were thousands of rishis who have written Upanishads and, you know, all the Mahabharata and all those other, I mean, Mahabharata, of course, by Ved Vyasji, but like Ramayana and all the Brahma Sutras and all that, so much is there. But Ved Vyasji was the one who organized it. And there was nothing that is written ever in history that was not written by Ved Vyasji. Anything in any spiritual book of the world, in any religion, if you look at it, is already there, written by this great soul. So not only he had the wisdom, but he had the courage to bring it to the modern way. You know, how to make this knowledge modern, understandable to all of us. So he had a beautiful combination. So para, sharya, vacha. So these are spoken by Ved Vyasji. Sarojam amalam. Just as there are pure water, there is a water from which the lotus grows. So here the water is the words of Ved Vyasji. And his words are very pure, amalam. So that is where this lotus of Mahabharata arises. Lotus, he will talk in the third verse, but it talks about the Mahabharata lotus. And why the lotus? As we had talked before, the lotus is worshipped or used in worship because A, it grows in dirty water. At the same time, it spreads this beautiful fragrance. Also, the lotus is not attached. If you see the lotus leaf, the water falls on the leaf and then slips away. So it means that you and I should be like the lotus leaf. Live in the world, but don't let the world get over you, on top of you. Live in the world, deal with the world, get what is the best, and then spread it to everybody. But do not get touched or contaminated or polluted by what is happening. So that is the lotus leaf. That's why you and I have to be like a lotus. So sarojam amalam, so that the waters which nourish this lotus of Mahabharata is the parasharya, parashar's words. Talking about detached, there's this little story I told in my Thursday class. So those of you who are here. So there was this man who goes to this great yogi and says, I want to learn how to meditate. Okay, sit down. So he sit down. He says, back erect. Close your eyes, relax your body from head to toe. He relaxes the body. Take slow, deep breaths, three slow, deep breaths. He does. He says, now slowly drop your cell phone. That is, even when we go to meditate, we take our cell phone, even in the bathroom, even in the bedroom. It's, you know, the cell phone has become even more dear than our spouse. You know, spouse, if we lose, is okay, but shouldn't lose my cell phone. What am I going to do with my contacts? So that's why he says, be like the lotus leaf. Don't be attached to objects. So para sharya vacha saroja mamalam gitartha gandotkatam. And now the lotus has to have fragrance, right? If there's a flower, it doesn't have fragrance, then it might as well be a paper flower or a plastic. So what is the fragrance of the Mahabharata, the entire story of 100,000 verses? The fragrance is the Gita. The Gita, which is only 700 verses out of 100,000, is the fragrance, which is the best part of the whole lotus of Mahabharata. But to enjoy the fragrance, you have to know Gita Artha. What is the meaning? See, a lot of people know or have read the Bhagavad Gita or have heard the Bhagavad Gita, but they do not go deep into the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita. Or even if they have understood, they don't apply it in their life. So unless you apply the Bhagavad Gita, you have not really learnt it. Just as a doctor, he may have studied medicine, passed the boards, but if he does not apply that in doing surgery or seeing a patient, then his knowledge is incomplete. Or an engineer building, learning civil engineering or chemical engineering, and then when he's asked to build a dam or build a road and is not able to practice it. So Gita Artha is the fragrance. And Nana Khyanak Kesharam. And there are a lot of stories in the Mahabharata, anecdotes, lot of, you know, different incidents. So those are the petals. See, a lotus has to have petals. So those are the petals. And what are the, those are the narratives, and what are the how does these petals bloom? The petals to bloom, it needs the soft wind. That's what they say, the soft wind makes the petals bloom. So the soft wind which makes it blue means devotion to Lord Hari, devotion to Krishna. So we have to have devotion to the Lord to really enjoy the Gita and the Mahabharata, or to enjoy any scripture. Unless you have love or devotion for the Lord, your study will be incomplete. So Nanak Khyanam Kesaram Hari Katha Sambodhana Boditam. So the stories of Krishna are is the soft wind which makes the petals bloom. Loke Sajjana Shat Padair Ahar Ahar. So this is a very beautiful one. To enjoy the petals and to enjoy the lotus, who comes there? The bee. Right? And the bee is said to have Shat Pada, has six legs. So here, who are the people who have six legs? It's people like us, who have the desire to know the Bhagavad Gita. Just as the bee goes deep into the flower and it extracts the honey, the essence. So you and I also have six legs, the five sense organs, which take in all the information, the eyes, ears, nose, skin and tongue. And then the mind which absorbs it. So these are my six legs with which I study the Bhagavad Gita. So not only you listen to it, not only you read it, but you let it go into the mind. Ahar, ahar, daily, every day, constantly Bhagavad Gita should be studied every day. As I have said before, there are 700 verses. Besides this reading what we discuss in the class, each one should read at least two verses every night before you go to bed, in addition to whatever else you are studying. So two verses a night, if you study with interest, carefully, and then contemplate, in 1 year you would have studied the entire Bhagavad Gita, 700 verses in 350 days. So minimum two verses. So ahar aha means every day it should be studied and it should be enjoyed. Vepiya manam muda, and they drink it with great joy. See, we have to drink the Bhagavad Gita not as a dry text. Somebody said something to somebody else. Krishna said something to Arjuna somewhere, you know, thousands of years ago. No, he said it to me, and it is something I have to enjoy. And the Bhagavad Gita, the more, especially Gurudev's commentary, I would recommend everybody should read it in detail. The more you read it, the more you will realize his tremendous grasp of English. If nothing else, just read the first chapter. I was reading it today and I was blown away by his English, his command. Even we all think we know Krishna's life. He has written 3 pages in the introduction about Krishna's life. Nobody would have known Krishna as in those 3 pages. The way he has talked about it, it's unbelievable. As we were driving today from San Francisco, I was reading about Krishna, and those 3 pages right in the first chapter in the general introduction, everybody should read that. You will get a real different understanding of who Krishna is. So we should enjoy that. Bhuyat Bharata Pankajam. So this is the Pankajam, the lotus of Mahabharata. And what does it do? Kali Mala Pradvamsi Na Shreyase. Kali Mala means the evil. Pradvamsi, it destroys the evil, and Shreyase, and brings good in our life. Now there's a little bit of Sanskrit grammar. I thought I'll do it. This is something I enjoy a little bit. So he says, Na is us. So for us, Kali Mala Pradvamsi, it destroys the evil, and Na Shreyase, and it helps bring good in us. So what the poet has done, saved one word. Instead of saying, it removes the evil in us and brings the good in us, he just leaves one. So what is this term? It is called Delhi Deep Nyaya. You must have heard Prabhuji's commentary. He talks about that. So he says, just as if there is a 2 rooms, right? And they're next to each other. And you only have one lamp, little lamp, and you want to illumine both rooms. If you put it in one, other room is dark. So what do you do? Delhi. In that threshold, you put it there so that one lamp illumines both room. It's called Delhi Deep Nyaya. Delhi mein deep laga do. So similarly here, by putting Na, the author, the poet has used it in 2 different places. So that's just little Sanskrit grammar I thought I would share with you. It's interesting. Then the 8th verse. Do we want to talk a little bit about this? Anybody has any questions or comments about this verse, or can we move on? Yes.
Where was the word with the na in it?
Na in the end. Na Shreyase. The last line of the 7th verse.
Okay.
Na. Na means to us. Okay, then he says, Mukam karoti vachalam pangum langayate girim yat kripa tamham vande paramanand madhavam. So this is a very famous verse which people always chant. So it is in a simple translation, and then I'll talk about the symbolic meaning. So mukam karoti vachalam. So mukam means a person who is dumb, who cannot speak, mute you can say. Because dumb has two different meanings, but the one who is mute, karoti vachalam, makes him speak. And pangum langayate girim, and a person who is lame, pangum means lame, one leg is not functioning. Langayate girim can reach the top of the mountain. So a person who is mute can speak, and a person who is lame can top of the mountain. Why? Yam yat kripa, that kind of grace, tamaham vande, O Krishna, O Lord, Paramananda Madhavam, O Krishna, O Lord, your grace and compassion that we ask for, because your grace is the one that makes a mute person speak or makes a lame person cross a mountain. So that grace we want from you, Madhavam. So Krishna's another name is Madhavam. And the word Madhavam means, there was a demon called Madhu and Kaitab. There were two demons, and Krishna, of course, in his life destroyed many demons. So he is known as the destroyer of demon Madhu. But he is Paramanand. See, one is the pleasure we get from objects. Like I eat an ice cream or have a slice of pizza, I get some pleasure. Or I buy a new car or a new house or a new piece of jewelry or a new dress or a new diamond. So these are, or a new spouse, you know, or a new child. You know, so these are all the joys we get from objects. Now those joys are fleeting. You know, new spouse, how long does the joy last? I don't want an answer, I'm sure you all can tell. A new child, wait till he becomes a teenager. Then you say, oh my God, I'm pulling my hair if this child only listens. And once they go to college, forget it. What they do, you have no idea. So, same way, a new car or a new house afterwards starts giving problems. Car becomes old, starts breaking down in the middle of the road at night. You know, you're calling AAA, your house is middle of the night, the pipes are leaking, and you're... So everything in life temporarily gives us pleasure, but then ultimately leads to sorrow, because life is like that. Nothing is permanent. Joy and sorrow are there in everybody's life. But the joy from the Lord, from Krishna or Buddha or Jesus or Father in heaven or whoever, the joy obtained from knowing the Lord, Shiva or Mother Saraswati, is Paramanand. It is the highest joy, and it is Anand. It is bliss. It's not joy, it's not pleasure. It is bliss, and the bliss comes because it's from within. God is not only outside. By knowing Lord, you experience His presence within. So it is the supreme joy, and that is within. That will never end. See, nobody can take away me from myself. You know, my object, my person, my husband can stop loving me, my children, my house, my jewelry, everything will go away. But I will always be there. So the joy found within is the joy of knowing God. That's why it's called Paramanand. It is permanent and it is the highest. It is not related to any objects. It is not temporary. It is not something that somebody can give me or take it away. So that's why they say, find the joy within, then the world may or may not give you joy. You don't depend on the world. So look for it within. And that's what we do in our meditation. We go within and find who I really am. So that is who my nature is. So that is the simple meaning, that he makes the lame person walk and makes the mute person. There is actually a very beautiful bhajan. I think some of you... Darshan do Ghanshyam Anath, meri akhiyan pyasi re. He says, O Lord Ghanshyam, come and see me because my eyes are thirsty to see you. And then there is a very beautiful verse which connects very beautiful. He says, Dwara dayaka jab tu khole, pancham surme gunga bole, andha dekhe, langada chalkar, pahunche kashi re. thing. If you haven't heard it, please listen to that on YouTube. It is a Darshan Do Ghanshyam. So he says that Dwara Daya Ka Jab Tu Khole, when you open your doors of compassion, you know, when you become compassionate, Pancham Sur Me Gunga Bole, even a person who is dumb can sing with five different ragas, five different tunes. With ragas, he can sing, he can become an accomplished singer. So the way you can interpret one is, of course, you know, with a miracle he can do it. But also it shows that a person like Narendranath, he became, with the contact of the guru, became Vivekananda. Menon, you know, he became Swami Chinmayananda with the contact with Tapovan Maharaj. So what they are saying is that with this knowledge, even an ordinary individual can become, you know, an accomplished speaker. So I was thinking a little bit about myself, not that I'm in that same category, but I really feel bad. I really don't know that much. I'm not that smart. I haven't read too many Upanishads or Brahma Sutras. I never went to any course, never took a 1 year, 2 years. It is just by contact with Gurudev, Swami Chinmayananda and all the Acharyas that I'm able to, whatever little I'm able to contribute. So it is the same thing, that a person may be not very accomplished, but if the Lord and the Guru is with you, and that is what Shankaracharya ji very beautifully in Guru Paduka Stotram, those of you who have heard it, it is a homage to Guru Paduka, to the feet of the Guru. And his Guru, Govind Pada, was, he actually met him when he was, I think, about 10 or 12. By then, he had already, since age 5, been writing commentaries on various Upanishads and teaching and preaching, and already was a very evolved master. But in this Guru Paduka Stotram, he says the Mukascha Vachas Patita Vitabhyam Namo Namasyai Guru Padukabhyam. He says, I prostrate to my Guru, who I was a mukam, I was a dumb person. Even though he was such an accomplished master, he says, but when I went to the Guru, he made me a Vachaspati. He made me an orator. So the point is that once we offer our prostrations to the Guru, why? Because the Guru is the one that Lord speaks through the Guru. See, the Lord himself, how does he speak? Either he appears as Krishna or Ram or Jesus. He comes on earth as the incarnation, or he comes as a guru. So guru is the same stature as God. And so when a guru's grace is there, that is the Lord's grace is there. So that's why we should touch the feet of the guru or prostrate to the guru. Not that he wants to be treated as special, or it doesn't, not that it will fatten his ego. But A, it makes us humble. Humility is necessary, that by myself I am nothing. And that line we have to understand very clearly. By myself I am nothing. It is the Guru and the Lord who has made us whatever we are. And also the feet of the Guru represent the knowledge. Because what does the Guru stand on? His feet, right? That's why the Guru Padukas are worshipped. So similarly, a wise person stands on his knowledge. So the knowledge are the feet. So if we stand, it is on the knowledge. So when I prostrate to the Guru and touch the Guru's feet, I am prostrating to the knowledge and to that Brahman who is in the Guru, not the physical form. So he says, Dwara Dayaka Jab Tu Khole, Pancham Surme Gunga Bole. Then he says, Andha Dekhe. So when a wise person can speak, and when the Lord's grace is there, even a blind person can see. And there are instances where people were blind and, you know, the Lord blessed them or the Guru blessed them and they were able to see. But in this instance, it's not physical blindness. You know, physical, there are how many blind? But what it says is all of us are blind. We are all blind. Yes, physically we are able to see the time and the people and all that. But the truth behind the world we are not able to see, which is the true essence. The essence of everything is Brahman. That consciousness is the essence of all of us. It's there in every human, every animal, bird, plant, fish. It's even there in the chair. Everything is the Lord, everything. But you and I are not able to see. That's why we go around and say, have you seen God? We go ask Guru, have you seen God? God is here. He's here in this pointer. Where do you need to go see him? You just have to recognize him and treat everybody as God, everybody as me, because everything is that. When everything is God, then I am also that. So it does not mean I am God, but everything is that Brahman, that divinity. And you and I are so blind. That's why we see all the differences. This is my friend. This is my enemy. This belongs to my caste, my community, my state, my religion, my color, my mind constantly. Everything is Brahman. Just see the world as that. And then even inanimate objects you treat properly. Your shoes, your car, your, everything is God. So you don't throw things here. Don't keep the house dirty. Keep everything clean because Brahman is everywhere. Not only God's temple, but even my bedroom is God's temple. My office is, everything is, my kitchen, my closet. So everything should be kept good. So that is called Andha Dekhe. And then Langada Chalkar Pahunche Kashire. So he says even a lame person can climb the mountain to the top where it, the abode of Lord Shiva is. You know, he says Kashi, he lives in Kashi. So what it means, Langada, one, of course, it means one who is lame, whose one leg is deficient and one leg is healthy. So that is called lame. But the other meaning that Swami Chinmayanandaji in his commentary says that we have two legs that we walk on, that is the mind and the intellect. For those for whom this chart is new, this our equipment is the body, mind and intellect. That is how we function in the world. Body I have, with the body I perceive the objects, with the mind I feel the emotions, and with the intellect I think the thoughts. Vasanas are my tendencies. We'll be talking about that periodically in the Bhagavad Gita. And Om represents God's presence. You can put here Shiva, Krishna, Jesus, whatever you want, but it is God's presence. So the mind is my seat of emotions and the intellect is my seat of thoughts. So mind is called Samshayatmak Vritti and intellect is called Nishchayatmak Vritti. What does it mean? Samshayatmak means which has doubts. So the mind has doubts, you know, should I do this? Should I do that? Should I, you know, go here? Should I do that? Should I help somebody or not? Should I come to Gita class on Sunday or should I sleep in? So all those doubts come and the intellect decides, no, 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 this is the right thing to do. So the intellect is called Nishchayatma. Now if the intellect decides, usually the intellect, if the intellect is guided by the scriptures, and that is a very, very important. Everybody has an intellect, but is your intellect guided by the scriptures? Swami Bodhatmanandaji always says, a pure intellect is one that is guided by the scriptures. If you have any doubt, read the scriptures. So the intellect that is guided by the scriptures then decides, okay, this is the right thing to do. And then the mind follows. So that is the right way to happen. And ultimately the mind and intellect work together. And that is called yukta. That is called a united individual. But suppose the mind says, I'm not going to listen to the intellect. I'm going to do what I want. I'll just sleep. I have to, you know, I had decided I'll get up in the morning, do some yoga, meditation. Alarm rings, shut it off, you know. Or I had decided I'm going to, you know, diet and eat this and that. And when the time comes, I don't follow. Or I had decided I'm going to go in the morning and do some community service. I'm feeling, don't feel good. Now I get up, pick up the phone and call them. I'm sick or my child is sick. So the mind, if it follows the instructions of the intellect, is called united. And such a person is working on two legs. But if the mind decides to do what it wants, or the intellect does not have the right information, then such a person is said to be lame. Another meaning is that some people are very emotional. They have a lot of love for God. They get up in the morning, they do prayers, but they don't have the right knowledge. Or other people have a lot of knowledge, but they are very arrogant. I know more than anybody else. I can chant the mantras. I can, you know, do this. I can do that. So the intellect has to have the right knowledge and the mind has to have love for Lord. But if you only have one, if you only have love for God and you don't have knowledge, then your mind is strong, the intellect is weak. So you are langda, you are lame. Or if the intellect is very powerful, very intelligent, I know everything, but I have no love for God, that is also langda. So you need the grace of God and the grace of the Guru so that my mind, which is filled with love, should have the right knowledge to go towards that. So that's why it says, Mukam karoti vachalam pangum langayate girim. And then I put one more, that it not only makes the dumb person speak or the lame person walk, but also makes the blind person see. One who cannot see the world. And that's what Gurudev's teachings actually, I sometimes think about myself. If Gurudev had not come into our life since the 90s, you know, we have been listening to him and reading and all. Where would we have been? You know, if Gurudev had not come, we wouldn't even have this mission. You know, there would have been, all the teachers are not here. It is Guru, one man's vision that he was inspired to create this beautiful structure called Chinmaya Mission, which now has 300 centers like this. And there are, some of the centers have up to 2,000 children. Here we have 160. And they have hundreds of adults in their classes. So the point is that if the Guru had not come, where would we be today? Would we be anywhere? No, we would be like anybody else, going to work, coming home, Friday, you know, going to a party, Saturday traveling, Sunday. That's all. You know, that's majority of the people live like that because they are not exposed to the right knowledge. So that's why we should be thankful to God and to Gurudev that we have the opportunity to study the Bhagavad Gita. So, Yat Kripa Tamaham Vande Paramananda Madhavam. So, O Krishna, we would like you to give us the supreme joy and give us the vision, the ability and the right knowledge. So that's what Krishna does. Now the last verse, it's a very, very beautiful verse. Gurudev says that everybody, first of all, should memorize it, which most of you have done. Yam, Rama, Varunendra, Rudra, Maruta, everybody knows. Secondly, you should know the meaning. And thirdly, you should contemplate on the meaning every day. So it should be a part of your meditation. So those of you who don't meditate, we do have a meditation class on Thursday evening, 6:30 to 7:30, where we teach meditation and we do some group guided meditation. So you are welcome to come there. So he talks about who Brahman. Now who is Brahman? It's called Brihat Vat Iti Brahman. Briha means big. So Brahman is big. So you say big what? Say, no, big of nothing. So is it like a big house or a big island or a big planet or a big star or a big mountain? No, it is big. There is no, it's not an adjective. It doesn't define anything else. Usually for us, big is okay. This house is bigger than that house. This mountain is bigger than that mountain. This continent is bigger than that continent. This planet is bigger than that planet, the star is bigger, like there are some stars which are million times or billion times bigger than our sun. But they say, no, this is big. Big is what? That there is no adjective, it is personification of big, that is Brahman, Briha. Briha means big. So what does that big mean? Brahman, first of all, is big in the sense of it extends beyond everything, even beyond space. Even space is included in Brahman. It extends way beyond space, not only in distance, but also it is even all the other worlds, not only this world, but there are 13 other worlds, Chaudhe Lok. So it is beyond all the 14 worlds, all the heavens, all the hells. Everything is, it is beyond all of those, and it is the big. So that Brahman is cannot be described because it has no qualities. It has no properties. The Upanishad says, Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha. So what it means is that Brahman cannot be described by speech, cannot be thought about by mind, of course cannot be seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched. So if I cannot describe it, I cannot think about it, I cannot see it, I cannot hear it, how am I to know it? You know, even the mind cannot think about it. No. Can the intellect understand it? No. Then what is the use? Why am I sitting here on Sunday then, you know, if I cannot think about it? So they say the Upanishads are the closest to indicating what is Brahman. So they only can indicate. They cannot take us there, just as I've given the example before. Suppose it is dark, and then the moon is just barely risen. It's a crescent moon, you know, just on the second day. And it is just rising above the horizon, and there is a tree. And somebody says, "Where is the moon?" He said, "There is the moon." He said, "I can't see it." So you point your finger. You say, "See that branch of the tree? Yes. See the second branch here? Between the two branches, if you pay your attention, there, look where my finger is. You'll see a little crescent moon." You say, yeah, I see the moon. Now my finger is not the moon, right? And the finger cannot even reach the moon. The finger is far away. But the finger points to the moon. So similarly, these Upanishads are not Brahman. Bhagavad Gita, even though it came from the Lord's mouth, is not that highest reality. All these scriptures do is they like the finger. They can point to the highest reality. They can indicate that this book will tell us where to look if you want to find God. Of course, God is in the temple and church and mosque, but that is the form of God. But the true nature of God is formless. And that cannot be understood, can only be indicated by the scriptures. But also, what it means, don't get stuck on the finger. Don't keep looking at the finger. Where is God? Where is the moon? Where is the moon? No. Don't look at my finger. Look where I am pointing. So similarly, a lot of people get stuck in the books. They say, book alone is, I've read the Gita, I'm done. Or I've read Bible, I know everything. No. What the Gita is pointing at, look at that. So, and also don't become fanatical. Oh, Gita alone is good, or Bible alone is good, or Quran alone is good. All scriptures point to that truth. All you have to do is pick one that suits you and apply that and study that properly and get the hidden message. That's why Gita Gandotkatam, in the last verse we had studied, in the seventh verse, that the artha, the meaning, what the Gita is indicating, that one has to know. So that is, in brief, just the introduction to the ninth verse, which is a very beautiful verse. Yam Brahma. Yam means that Brahman, that Yam, big Brahman. Again, at the end, he says, Devaya Tasmai Namah. To that Lord, that Supreme Being, I prostrate. Whom do I prostrate to? Devaya Tasmai Namah. That's the last three words of the last verse. So he says, who is that God? Yam, to him, Brahma. Brahmaji is the creator. Varuna is the Lord of the ocean. Indra is the king of gods, like Zeus in the Greek mythology. He's the king of gods. Rudras are the... I can just talk a little bit about as we go along. So Brahmaji, as we all know, is the creator of the universe. Then, of course, Vishnu sustains and Shiva destroys. Varuna is the lord of the ocean. Indra is the lord of all the gods in heaven. Also, he's said to be the lord of the mind. So it is said Indra, even he took him 99 years. He stayed with his guru for 99 years before he could understand the truth. So that's why it shows how important it is, the role of a guru. Indra, Rudra. Rudra is a very interesting word. Rudra means Rodayati iti Rudra. So one who makes us cry. Rodaya means to cry, Rona. So what makes us cry when we suffer, right? When there is a loss, or where there is a tragedy, or I have some pain. So it is, they said, these are the celestial powers called Rudras that make us cry. But it's not they who make us cry. What makes us cry? Our own karmas. It is our own actions which make us cry. It is nobody, not God sitting somewhere, or Rudra, or a devil, or a Satan, or somebody who is making me suffer, or Yamaduta, none of that. It is my own karmas that make me cry or make me laugh. So if I'm crying, I have done something wrong in my previous birth or in this birth. And if I'm laughing, I have done something good. If I'm happy, something good. If I'm sad, something bad. So then we stop blaming anybody. It's not my spouse, not my boss, not my neighbor, not my child, not the economy, not Trump. Nobody is making me cry. I am making myself cry. So Rudras are just a personification, these deities that give us the karma phala. So when you have done bad actions, Rudras are the gods that give us this, the fruit of suffering. So he says, even those gods, and Maruta is the god of wind, Stunvanti Divya Istai. So with divine verses, they praise God. So they praise this Brahman. So that's why all the divine verses, that a lot of stavas, a lot of these verses which are in all our scriptures, which are sung in praise of God. So we say, is God like a politician? You know, you go and praise him. You say, sir, you are the greatest senator ever in the history of California. Why you are saying that? Because you want, you know, a contract from him. So you go slip him a few $1,000 and praise him, and then you get the contract. So is God like that? You know, you go praise him and then you put some money in the temple and offer him a flower and candle, and, you know, he'll get praised. No, that's not. God is not a politician. He's not like a worldly politician that if you praise him or give him something. The reason we praise God is for us, because when you fill your mind with the divine thoughts, what it does, first of all, if you enter temple and just chant the name of the Lord, even if you're not in a temple or church, even at home, you get up in the morning, close your eyes, just say Om Namah Shivaya, Shri Krishna, Saranam Mama, name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. You remember the Lord, instantly your mind becomes soft, becomes pure, becomes calm. So by remembering the Lord, A, it makes me happy, it makes me peaceful, and it expresses humility, gratitude. Oh Lord, you are so praiseworthy. You have created this beautiful earth for me, and the planets and the stars and the flowers and the birds chirping, and all my life, my body, my mind, my intellect, everything is your gift to me. So I am grateful to you, Lord. So the praise is not because God needs praise. He's all perfect. He knows what he is. It is for us to recognize. It's like when anybody does something good for you, you know, you express your gratitude, not to fatten that person's ego, but just to express your gratitude. Thank you for doing it. And that person should again, if somebody praises him, should Krishnarpanamastu. All praise, transfer it to God. So all these powerful deities constantly praise him. Stunvanti divya istavai. Then what happens? Then what happens in the Vedas, especially the Sama Veda? It is said all the Vedas are beautiful, but the Sama Veda is full of songs. It is musical. It is sung. So Vedai Sanga Pada Kramopanishadai Gayanti Yam Samaga. So they sing where? In the Vedas, in the Padas and Kramas. These are the sections of the Vedas. And the Sama Veda especially is fulfilled with songs and chants and beautiful. So people who chant the Vedas, people, you know, there are some people who are very good with Vedic chanting. And the chanting, as they say, has to be done very precise. There's Anuswara and all those things. There is a line above, it means different. Two lines below means different. I don't know that much. I've listened a little bit to Jayashree. I've sat with her in her classes. So, but the people who truly chant correctly, they know where if the dot is above, it means this, all that. There are two dots. So it has to be chanted correctly, but it has to be chanted with devotion and meaning. The chanting should not make you again arrogant that I am better than thou, you know, or the one who goes to the temple more often is the better than the one who doesn't go. Of course, going to the temple is good because it purifies your mind, but it should be done not with arrogance, but with love. This reminds me of a very beautiful story I just read today. So there was this priest who was very good speaker, you know, spoke beautifully about the Lord and very praised the Lord very well. And he also chanted beautifully all the hymns, you know, from all the Bible and all the spiritual hymns. A beautiful singer he was, very accomplished. He was that accomplished and that evolved that actually he could see God. He could see God, but he always saw God from a distance. God never came close to him or to him, but he could see. That's how evolved he was. So one day in church, he was standing at the pulpit and beautiful sermon he was delivering and singing beautiful hymns full of, you know, beautiful voice he had and sounded so nice. And he saw God approaching. He said, oh, finally, God is coming to meet me. And the God got that. It was like a light, like a presence, you know, little energy. And it came and sat next to a three-year-old boy and stayed for a few minutes. And this person was wondering, you know. And then the did God disappear? The energy was gone. He said, what happened? Why did God come to this three-year-old and not come to me? I have been preaching for the last 30 years and I'm singing such beautifully the hymns. So he was wondering. So after the sermon was over, church was over, the service, he goes and talks to that three-year-old boy. He says, when I was singing, what were you doing? So he said, I was chanting A, B, C, D up to Z. You were chanting ABCD? He said, well, that's, you know, three-year-old boy, that's all he knows. So, well, why were you chanting ABCD? He says, look, I told God, look, I don't know how to sing your praises. All I know is ABCD up to Z. I'm saying it. Now you pick the letters and make your own song for your own praise. It's your job. I cannot make a song. So you pick C, A, B, whatever. All the songs of the world are included in ABCD up to Z, right? I don't know how. And he said, and God picked the perfect song to praise himself. I didn't need to. So that's why God came to me, because it was he composed that song for himself. I didn't have to do anything. So the point is that it is not what we say, but with what attitude. So they are both important. Of course, one is good to be able to chant and to sing and have all the knowledge, but that should be accompanied by love and faith. That if I'm chanting, God will come. The little boy had that faith. He said, God, you are here. You make your own song. So that's why Vedai Sangha Pada Kramopanishadai Gayanti Yam Samagaha. So the persons who are chanting these mantras from the Upanishads correctly are chanting with you in mind, devoted to you, directed towards you. Then the third line is dhyana vasthita tadgatena manasa pashyanti yam yoginaha. So dhyana vasthita, so sitting in deep meditation, dhyana means meditation, avasthita means sitting in deep meditation, tadgatena manasa, with the mind gone in that direction, tadgatena manasa pashyanti, pashyanti means they see. Yam, they see that Brahman, yogina. Remember, we just said God cannot be seen, Brahman. So how? What do you mean by they see? So the word see, pashyati, when it comes in Gita, does not mean seeing, it means knowing. Like as I've said before also, there's a difficult math problem and somebody solves it. You say, oh, I see. Or you're trying to do a puzzle, you know, the word puzzles and word jumble and all, and you can't do it and somebody helps you. Oh, I see. So when you say, I see, it does not mean that you didn't see it before, but you understood the meaning or the solution to it. So similarly, when they say that these yogis in their meditation see God, it does not mean they see physically with their eyes. They see in their mind. They know because their mind is totally saturated. And seeing Brahman or knowing Brahman is becoming Brahman. So they become one with God. So you cannot know Brahman as an object. Brahman is not that one time I'm sitting in meditation and then suddenly a light will appear. You know, people in meditation look for blue light, or they look for a sound, you know, some ringing of the bells, and then there'll be a blue light. And then God will appear and say, ask what you want, son. And I'll say, God, I have seen you. I got everything. But now that you are here, can you please give me 5 million? You know, that is how we have this idea that somehow God will appear and make us millionaire. No, God is the subject. He is the knower. He is the one that knows everything. So knowing God is becoming one with God. That's why Brahmavit Brahmaiva Bhavati. So knower of Brahman becomes Brahman. Becomes Brahman does not mean he becomes God. He becomes one with God. So when they say that these wise yogis, meditators see God, what they mean is they experience his presence as me. And that's why they say that we have a lower nature and a higher nature. The lower nature is eight. Eyes, ears, nose, skin and tongue, 5, mind, intellect and ego. So these are my 8 lower nature, Ashtamurti Vrit, that's what Raman Maharishi says. So we have 8 components, the eyes, ears, nose, skin and tongue, mind, intellect and ego. So these 8 are my lower nature, And Om is my higher nature. Brahman is my higher nature. So the body, mind, and intellect, the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, objects, emotions, and thoughts, all Krishna calls as my lower nature and my higher nature. So for all of us, this is my lower nature, this body, mind, intellect. But Om or Brahman or consciousness is my higher nature, and it is my nature. It is not God's nature, and I am not separate from God. We cannot be. Even if you want to be separate, you cannot be. That's why they say, Kan Kan Me Bhagwan. Every cell is pervaded by God. How can you escape? You can't get away. Every thought of yours, every emotion, even at night, your cells are multiplying, your blood is being made, your respirations are going on, your heart is beating, digestion is going on. All that is going on. You are not doing it. You are in your sleep. It is that Lord, that consciousness, every cell of my body, we have 4 billion cells, they're all multiplying, growing, functioning because of that. So that you just experience as you, as me. So that is dhyana vasthita tad gatena manasa pashyanti yam yoginaha. The yogis see that God, perceive it, know it as themselves. Yasya antam. Antam means the end. Na vidu, don't know. Who do not know? Sura, asura. Sura is the gods, the demigods. Asuras are the demons. They do not know it. To that deva, to that Brahman, to that consciousness is my prostration. So, antam has two meanings. One is the end. That where does space end? Do we know? No, you can never reach the end of space. But consciousness is even beyond space. Even where space ends, consciousness keeps going further and further. In the Purusha Suktam, it is said that that Purusha, that supreme consciousness, 1/4 became this whole universe. This whole universe, including the 14 worlds and the entire space, was only 1/4 of that. 3/4, tripad urdhva udayat purushah. Pado esya bhavat punah. Again and again, this world is created only out of 1/4 of God. 3/4 is beyond that. So it is beyond the 14 worlds. It is anta. We don't know ananta, where it is. That is how far that Lord extends. And anta also means what is the purpose, what is the goal, what is the attitude, what is the purpose of, what is the motive. What God is, what does he do? Even the Sura and Asura, even the gods and the demons cannot know that. To that Deva, we must my prostrate. She said, God and demons cannot know it. Even Indra cannot know it, or even Rudras. How am you and I to know it? That's why he says, be like the yogis. It is only in this human birth that you can know God or reach God. You cannot reach him if you are in heaven. You are enjoying all the pleasures of heaven. Heaven is what? It's Hawaii, multiplied 100 times. So you can, you know, drink what you want, eat what you want, enjoy what you want. But you cannot, and when you are having fun and enjoying, where you have time to think about God, you know, where all the apsaras are dancing, there's beautiful dance going on and music and drink. You can drink whatever you want, eat whatever you want. You never gain weight. You have a big house of 24 bedrooms where you have time to think of God. There you're just there to have fun. That's why Kshine Punye Martya Lokam Vishanti. So once you enjoy heaven, then you come back to the earth. And of course, in hell, definitely you don't have time. You're being beaten, you know, kodas, and you're being dipped in hot oil and all when you have done all those. So there again, you don't have time to think about God. So they say only in this human birth is the only opportunity you have to know God. That's why even the gods in heaven want to be born as humans, because human birth is after 84 lakh yoni, after 8.4 million births, you have got a human birth. So don't waste this opportunity. Do not spend it just in, you know, having fun and enjoying and all. Yeah, you need to do all that, but spend some time in knowing God and serving the world. So that's why the human birth is very important, and only yogis who are sitting in deep meditation can know or experience that Brahman. So to that Brahman, Devaya Tasmai Namaha, to that Brahman, we prostrate. Take a break. Any questions about any of these three verses, 7, 8, 9? I have the descriptions up there.
This rishis, mm-hmm. who are meditating day and night, they were hallucinating after some time?
No. Actually, see, there are two ways to meditate. One is meditation with a goal in mind. And there are some schools, I don't want to put any school down, but they say that when you progress, you hear bells, you see blue light. I haven't heard bells or I haven't seen any light. But it is said that those are steps that shows that you are progressing in meditation. That's what those schools say. I personally don't look for light. I don't look for sound. I just, when I meditate, try to go within and experience the inner self, God's presence within, through with breathing and chanting and all that. But if they do or hear it, it is said they are stepping stones in your spiritual journey. But majority of the yogis who meditate, they do not hear sounds, they do not see hallucinations. All they do is go deep within and experience the inner joy, the inner stillness, the inner peace. And so that experience is unlike any other experience you have had in the world. It's not like a light, it's not like a blue light or a sound or anything. It is the inner, your innermost core. It is experiencing Om. Om, not only chanting with the mouth, but experiencing that, what is called the Turiya state or the fourth state. See, there are three states, the waking, dream, and deep sleep. The fourth state is called Turiya, which is where the absence of all three is there. It is neither waking, nor dream, nor deep sleep. It is the substratum on which these three states are present. So whether I'm awake, whether I'm dreaming, or whether I'm in deep sleep, the Om is always alive, right? Even when I'm in deep sleep, God is functioning within me. So that fourth state is what they experience. So they do not hallucinate. No, these yogis, they are very evolved. They are one with God. And when they are sitting in that meditation, they can actually sit for years. That's why Raman Maharishi sat for, it is recent. I'm not talking about yogis 2,000, 5,000 years ago. This was in the 20th century when he was sitting in the Arunachal, in that cave under the temple. He actually sat for so many years in one place that the rock, he was embedded in the rock. He became part of the rock. And I'm talking recently. This is not something new, years ago. And he had stayed there for several years. How did he do that? Without eating, drinking, nothing. He was just, because what happens is in deep meditation, that BMR, basic metabolic rate, goes down to about, you know, very low. The heart rate drops to like 10, 15. And if you check their metabolism is almost zero. So in that state, they're able to live for years, and they actually had to dig him out of the rock when somebody found him. So the point is that they go into that state of oneness with God. It's not a trance. It's not something you... That's what people with LSD and ganja and dhatura and all, they thought it's the same thing. By, you know, taking LSD, they go into these hallucinations, and the same thing some of the sadhus in India do that. They take ganja and dhatura and all, thinking that they are experiencing ecstasy. That's not it. It is the joy within.
How do you express that experience?
So they do. That's what the Upanishads are. That's what the Bhagavad Gita is. All of them, see, this state cannot be expressed in words. That's why there was a famous saint in Gujarat, Prannaji. He says, okay, what I have experienced, I cannot put in words. But still, even though he cannot put in words, he has written a book of 18,000 verses. He says, if you cannot put in words, you have written 18,000 verses. He says, I'm trying my best to experience that state. It is beyond all words. Words cannot express it. Books are only indicators, as I said. So books will point to that. And these rishis, out of compassion for us, they don't need it. They don't need any praise. Like the Upanishads, the rishis who wrote didn't even put their name. We don't even know the name of half the Upanishads, who the rishi was. So they had no need for fame or name or prestige or money or power or Shishyas, nothing. Out of compassion for us, they composed these scriptures, whether it's the Bible or the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita or the Upanishads or the Brahma Sutras. All these scriptures were composed by these great prophets and saints for us, so that we may also, that's what Prahannaji says. He says, I cannot give you that knowledge, but why have I written this book of 18,000 verses? So that reading to that, you may be inspired to experience what I have experienced. So to inspire us to experience what they have experienced, they want us to read the scriptures and then look in the direction they are indicating. That's why that finger is very important. Finger is not the moon, but finger is indicating. So there, that's the finger which is telling us where to look if you want to find God.
So when we say the gurus are realized,
yes.
So I mean, at what point you can say that, okay, they are realized?
See, you and I cannot say that. Only one realized master can know another realized master. For you and me, they might look very ordinary. In fact, one time I heard Neeru was telling me the story that she went to this Chardham Yatra and Swamiji told her that this lady is a realized soul. So they said, how do you know? So they went to her ordinary, just wearing simple clothes, hair long, not even combed, looking very, I don't know, nothing special about her. Not there was a light shining or anything. Old lady, barely walking and even not taking care of her dress, her hair, her clothes, looking. So she said, well, what's special about her? They said, go close to her. So every lady who came, she would embrace and say, this is my Radha. And every man who came, she embraced him and said, this is my Krishna. So she saw only Radha and Krishna. She didn't see anything else. For her, the whole world was Radha and the whole world was Krishna. She didn't know anything else. That is realization, where you see God everywhere. You don't need to be. And she wasn't a good speaker. She hadn't written any Upanishads, hadn't written any text, wasn't giving any talks, didn't have an ashram mission following, nothing. She just lived there and stayed. So you and I cannot judge who is realized, and we shouldn't even judge. All we should do is, if there is somebody whose teachings like this, you know, appeal to us, we should listen to them, read them, apply them, and try to reach where they have reached. You know, it's they are like ideals for us. And if they have realized or not, that's their problem. And one realized master can know. That's why when Swami Chinmayananda went and met Raman Maharishi, you know, two great masters, it is said they went and they sat, and for half an hour nobody spoke. And the disciples were around and they said, you know, these two great masters are speaking. We're going to hear some wonderful words of wisdom, you know, Upanishads flowing and nothing. Half an hour, 45 minutes, they just sat in each other's presence, enjoying each other's company, because they both were in that state of bliss, of realization. So, and the people around were a little disappointed. Maja nahi aaya yaar, what happened? You know, these two great masters met and I didn't see anything. No, you don't have to speak. So you and I, all we can do is look up to them. And if they have realized, fine, let them worry about it and let God worry about it. And instead of judging, you know, he's realized and she's not. Am I realized? That's what I, and how do I know I realized? Do I experience myself as divinity? Do I see Krishna and Radha in everybody? If I do, then yes, I am. That, and see means genuinely see, not by mouth, but in her heart she felt. For her, there was nothing but God. She said, I see God everywhere. I don't need to go to a temple. I don't need to go to anywhere, to Kailash or nowhere. God is there with me right here. I see everyone. So it is very hard to judge who is realized and who is not. But the scriptures definitely have been written by realized masters. Of course, this Gita is by Lord Krishna himself. But the Upanishads and all, definitely the masters who composed it were realized. Brahma Sutras, Ved Vyasji, all of these, you know, Shankaracharya, all of Shankaracharya's compositions, if you read, you can tell that this is a realized master. Swami Chinmayananda's commentary, if you read the Bhagavad Gita with attention, nowhere in his life he has said, I am realized. In fact, when people used to ask him question and answers like you are asking, they say, God, Swamiji, are you realized? No. He would throw the question. Nowhere he said he was realized, but when he talks about that divine state of experience, which if you pay attention, or when he speaks, but a lot of times when he writes, you can tell that it is his own experience. He's not writing something that he has read in a book or listened to his guru. The subtle things come out that he's talking from his own experience. He's not verbally, like for example, what I'm speaking is just basically what Swami Chinmayananda and other acharyas have spoken. It's not my personal experience, you know. I'm just basically a tape recorder, you know, somebody, I just picked
so
up this knowledge.
Like it's like experiencing,
yes.
Not the expressing. You cannot
right.
express.
Right, right. But the reason they express, out of compassion for us, so that we may also experience what they have experienced. Out because that's what Swami Chinmayananda, he was sitting with his guru. You might have heard the story with Tapovan Maharaj in the Himalayas, in Uttarkashi. And after he had experienced the truth and stayed for several years, studied all the Vedas, Upanishads, he said, I want to travel, go to India and speak to the people. And his guru told him, he says, don't go, people won't appreciate. He said, no, but the people of India are suffering in ignorance. They have this wealth of Upanishads, Gita, all this knowledge, and people are still suffering in ignorance. I want to go to bring this knowledge to them. I need your permission, Gurudev. He was asking for the teacher's permission. And finally he said, okay, you want to go, you go. But remember, you'll have a lot of problems, because in those days, people were not ready for this knowledge. This is in the 1950. And, you know, he was met with a lot of opposition and people gave him a hard time. The first lecture he gave, there were only four people. You know, in Pune, that was the first talk. He talked on the Upanishad. And slowly by the end of that 1 month, his audience had grown to like 200 or 300 people, just from four people. And then from there, somebody told him, my auntie is in Chennai, I'll call her and you can go and give, because he was so impressed. And that's how, by word of mouth, you know, he spread. So he out of, and then not only that, but he said there are people all over the world who need this knowledge. And that's why Gurudev traveled to US and Canada and Asia and Africa and Europe and everywhere, you know, France and England and all, just to spread this knowledge, not for his own glory or his own grace, but that this knowledge should be made available to the world, because it will help them. It's like you have studied something, you know, you have studied medicine. And why are you studying? So to help people, not only to make money. If your goal is only to make money, then you're not going to be a good doctor. If your goal is, I should seek help people, and in the process, yes, I will get paid. And same thing for a teacher. I'm going there to make the students better, not to earn a paycheck. If you're doing just for a paycheck, then once I'm, what's that, tenure, then I don't care. You know, these professors and teachers, they just keep repeating every year the same, you know, material, last year's notes, they just repeat. No, I'm here to make the children better, because the children are our future and they are in my hand. Same way an engineer, you know, whatever I'm doing, I have to do it as, so that is, so same way this guru works for our improvement. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Anything else?
I think she was thinking of some, you know, some yogis, real yogis and real teachers and some fake yogis and...
Right, right.
Maybe...
Yes.
In India, there are still lots of fake yogis and...
True.
Rishis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she meant that.
Right, you know. Right. Right.
So I was thinking, Guru, then Prabhupada, all those gurus are realized souls. So I'm just wondering, like, What do they experience, or you said that we cannot judge, but like, what do they experience that they feel like they are realized? But I think it cannot be expressed. It's just that can be experienced.
Right.
So.
But the experience of all is the same. It's like you climb the mountain. Now, whether you go from this side, or you go from straight up, or you go the curvy road, or you go the, you know, climbing on rocks, or you walk, or you go by bike, or you go by car, or you go by rope. When you reach the top, experience of all is the same, right? And you reach the peak of the mountain, no matter what way you came, whether you took 1 day to reach or whether you took 1 month to reach. Once you reach the peak, the experience is the same. So when you read the writings, whether it's Christian mystics, whether it's Buddhist scholars, whether it's Upanishad saints, whether it's Sufis, whoever the writings, their language may be different, the wording and the expression, but the final description is very similar. Actually, I sometimes read the commentary of Eknath Ishwaran, where he and also where he talks about the various mystics, Christian saints. And what they describe is very similar to what the Upanishads have described. It's very interesting that the final experience of all is the same. They may choose to express it a little differently, but the undercurrent of sameness is there. And ultimately, the sameness is I and that are one. Aham Brahmasmi, that is the experience of all seekers. Whether they say it in Sanskrit or English or Arabic or Pali or whatever language, whatever Marathi, Gujarati, doesn't matter. The experience of I am that, that is the final experience, the oneness with God. And then such people then see God everywhere. Once you see God within, then you see God outside. And then they become saints or prophets and teachers, and because then they speak from their own experience. See, one is somebody has read a little books or got a little knowledge here and there, and then is speaking. You know, that is one. Another one is a person who is genuinely seeking the truth, and as he or she is learning, then expressing that. And the third is the realized soul who has experienced that and then is speaking. And those are the ones who have so, like, who speak and their knowledge spreads far and wide, like Buddha. He might have preached to a few hundred people. How many years and how much could he travel? Maybe a few thousand. Look, how many billion Buddhists are there? Christ preached the sermon to how many? 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 people, 100. And now look how many billions of Christians are there. Because the power of the word is very powerful. Swami Chinmayananda, even after he left his body in 1993, they thought, oh, Chinmay mission will die once Swami Chinmayananda leaves, because he was the mission. After that, the mission has tripled three times, because that's what Gurudev Swami Tejomayananda, somebody asked him. He said, how do you think the Chinmaya mission will function? He said, until now, Gurudev's presence, Gurudev's body functioned. Now, Gurudev's words will speak. So, this is the words of the teacher. And all the time, Tejomayanandaji, all the 23 years when he was head, he always said, I am at Gurudev's feet. He never said, I am the head of the mission. He said, I am working at, my guru is the one working through me, and it is his word that will carry. So, there, and this, the mission 100 years from now will be 10 times or 50 times bigger. It's actually the fastest growing Hindu organization in the world, because the work is very genuine. See, it's not because I'm sitting here or anything, but we have seen it from inside. Nobody gets a penny, not a penny gets, you know, misappropriated or cheated. All the money that is there, it's put either in publication or in making new centers, in training swamis. A lot of social work is going on. It's a very, very honest and genuine organization. We have been associated with it since 1990. And it is very well run, very efficiently run, and very honestly run. So every penny, so the whole basis of this organization is very, there is this Guru Paduka Stotram. I was just reading in the car, and actually you watch it on YouTube, and the gurus, they have shown the gurus of every mission of the world. They have shown Swami Chinmayananda, Tapovan Maharaj, Paramhans Yogananda, Christ, Sikh gurus, Buddhist gurus. They have not left anybody. So Nehru says only Chinmaya mission can do that. Again, I'm not trying to blow my horn, but the point is that we include all faiths as true. All religions are true. We don't try to promote fanaticism. The moment you become fanatic that I alone am better, then again, you know, I don't mean to sound that it is good. What I'm saying is they're all good. Whatever suits you, pick that. Oh, not at all. No. You didn't. I welcome questions. No, your questions are always very good. Thank you. No, I don't have any problem. Not at all. It's always good. Questions always, you know, makes it more interactive. Otherwise, it becomes a monologue. You know, it's questions are always good.
Yeah.
Particularly where Anil, you sent the PDU about the meditation. That was excellent, you know.
What one?
About the meditation, regarding about the meditation, different people were saying their yes. opinion. That is excellent. You know, sometimes when you say about meditation, people don't realize. But when you saw the video, say how many people are involved.
Right. Oh yeah, I emailed you that.
Yes.
That's
excellent.
I emailed
those. Shared with all my friends.
I have a meditation group. Those who have come to the class, we have an email list. So recently, I sent them a video about different authorities in the world speaking about their experience. You said, you know, experience. So these are different scholars mm-hmm. talking about what they experienced in meditation. So if you're interested, I can put you on the email list. Just give me your email address at the end. It's different from the Chinmay Mission. It goes out from my office. Not that it's a separate organization, but it's, you know, these are people who are a lot of mostly Westerners who have come, you know, to the classes. So we don't send them all the material that goes out of from Chinmay Mission, but things that pertain to them and pertain to meditation.
So you have a class on Thursday?
Thursday, 6:30, yeah. If you're interested, let me know. I'll send you a introductory YouTube video on meditation, which one of my students had recorded. Actually, Diana's daughter here, she's here. So she had recorded. So I'll send you that so you can watch it before you come. If you're coming, let me know. Thursday, 6:30. Or even after you come, I can send it to you afterwards. Yes.
It's time to go.
No, 1 minute we have.
I had kind of a certain, oh, I don't know what the word would be, but kind of like a dissonance that I feel when you say that all this world and the 14 heavens and all this, but that's one quarter. And why would they choose one quarter for something? Why would they say that this is a quarter of something that's
just to make it a part, just to give an expression that it is a one part of that. You could have said 1/5, 1/6, because infinite, a quarter of it or a fifth of it or an eighth of it is still not even infinite. It cannot be divided. It was just a way of poetic way of expressing. See, the poetic way of expressing that only a part of that became this universe. The most of it is beyond. So that's what they could have said 5/8 or 6/8. It doesn't matter. When it's infinite, it is infinite. The world is finite. Their idea of saying is the world is finite. And that is infinite. That is much more than what. So don't be just stuck in the world, but look, go beyond the world. Don't be just stuck in your mind, but go beyond the mind. That's what we try to do in meditation. Go beyond whatever the mind can comprehend. That is the idea. But no, that's a good question. Thank you.
When there is a confusion between mind and intellect, okay, mind is always like a confusion to go or not to go. So like today was also I experiencing there was a cricket match going on.
Right.
And I had to come here. So I experienced myself. Oh no, I should watch the Let It Be Today Sunday. I should have India Pakistan match. And then I thought, no, I should go to my class because then I will miss that. So like somehow my intellect said, no, you go. And my child also said, no, mom, you go to Chinmaya. Today like we are at home and you are going. So go. I'm your mother. I'm telling you, you go.
Good.
See. I said, okay.
That's a good child.
Then I should go.
Right.
So like how to pick up that right choice?
Yeah, you know inside what is the right choice. We are all humans,
sometimes
we know.
You subside that inside.
Right. So then that's when you are become lame. That's langda.
Mind overcomes intellect.
Yeah, mind overcomes the intellect, that is bad. But the intellect has to be guided by the scriptures. Intellect which is guided by the scriptures, not intellect guided by politics or, you know, economics or guided by the scripture. So what the scriptures say? Yeah, we'll end here. Thank you so much. We'll see you next Sunday, same time. We'll end with a closing prayer. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha, Sarve Santu Niramayaha, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashche Dukha Bhavet. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.